Hello, and welcome to Monumental, where we sit down with entrepreneurs, leaders, visionaries, and big thinkers making monumental change. Here's your host, Evan Holliday.
Welcome to Monumental. I'm your host, Evan Holliday, and today on the show, we have with us a good friend of mine, Mike Flaherty. Mike, how you doing, man? Great to have you on the show.
Good morning, Evan. It's an honor to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yes. Love Mike's energy. Love what he's doing. A little quick background. Mike and I are both in the same mastermind together, the Infinite Eight Mastermind. Some amazing guys in there. But a background on Mike, he's the founder and managing partner of L5 Real Estate Investments. Throughout his career, Mike has been involved in the ownership, development, and entitlement of more than 200 commercial and residential properties nationwide, valued at over $1 billion. And these include multifamily, resort, hospitality, office, retail, large master plan residential communities. I think he's done pretty much every sector of commercial development, it sounds like. He's worked internationally, domestically for Lendlease, British Petroleum, and Toll Brothers. I'm interested to hear about that experience. And his passion for multifamily investment performance is based on his niche for detailed due diligence, market analysis, and acquisition of value-add opportunities. Mike, with that, let's just dive right in and go into a little bit of your background and how you got into real estate.
Gosh, how did I get into real estate? It really came out of college. Actually, it came before college. As a kid, I always would look at land and say, hey, Dad, what can we build there? I always had an eye for envisioning what could be built in certain areas, primarily on the residential side. I would picture a house here or a house there, and I didn't know anything about anything at that point in time, let alone how to entitle things and build things and make money from real estate. I have a civil engineering degree from Villanova in Philadelphia, and that really started it. Fantastic academic institution, great network, and I was able to get a fantastic job with a young, growth-oriented civil engineering firm in the Northeast out of Philadelphia that managed a ton of real estate development for a lot of big Fortune 500 developers from Washington, D.C. up through Boston. And we managed all of the oil companies' work, ExxonMobil, Amoco, McDonald's, KFC, Taco Bell, Walgreens, Walmart, Home Depot, you name it. And at a very young age, I was thrown into, you know, providing professional testimony at planning commissions and city council meetings and battling angry neighborhood groups who didn't want a lot of what you're going through.
Yeah,
right?
I know how that goes.
We had all of our, like we were talking earlier, we had all of our rendering boards and we would go present at the planning commission and go back to the office and be prepared for the next day's hearing. And it was a baptism into, you know, a certain aspect of real estate that I really loved. To this day, I'm very involved with that group. I brought a lot of people into that organization that are still there. Two of my big investors are still part of that engineering firm. And that's really where it started. That was all commercial development at the time. And then I transitioned to residential after.
When you were at Villanova and even prior to that, with your fascination of land and what could go there, a side note, that's similar to actually how I got started. I would want to build like sports facilities. And I like designed a store that sold all chess merchandise because I was obsessed with chess at the time. But it was same thing, similar like kind of start to it. How did that passion when you were younger, segue into civil engineering?
I think it's just with engineering, building, real estate, it's all tangible, right? Everybody can relate to seeing something go up in their backyard or on the piece of land they grew up next to forever. And everyone can relate to a new home, or a new shopping center. So I think that was part of it for me. It just was something tangible that I could understand and I thought I could make an impact on. But my niche really started with that first job because I love doing these, what we call SIR, site investigation reports. You know, I wasn't passionate about doing grading reports and stormwater management design, but I love doing these site investigation reports and understanding, hey, what could be done at this specific property? What was permitted? What was not? What was the process? How could it be laid out? What were the pros? What were the cons? What were the big challenges? And I think that start was just a fantastic foundation for everything I've done since then, because it all relates to different aspects of real estate, different classes of real estate. And I've always been a big believer that, you know, a smart, prudent investment opportunity that can create, you know, fantastic return for you and your investors really starts with good, thorough due diligence and asking the right questions.
So walk us through how you segued from the civil engineering side over to, you said you started off in residential development, right?
It was mostly commercial. But as I said, I used to see land and build homes. So I wanted to get into residential. So after a couple of years, I always wanted to work for Toll Brothers. Toll Brothers is the largest luxury home builder in the United States. I was fortunate to be in Philadelphia at the time. Originally grew up in Washington, D.C. area in Maryland. And their headquarters were in Philadelphia. So it was a great place to be at a young age, call it, you know, 25, 24. They throw you into the mix as a project manager very quickly, and you're responsible for everything. You know, entitlements, construction, profit and loss, sales, marketing. So it's really baptism by fire, and you know, for a lot of people there's no better way to learn that.
So you were put in charge of finding and developing a new residential subdivision for Toll Brothers?
It wasn't really finding. They had their own acquisition people.
Got it.
But you're involved a little bit with that. You know, they put you involved a little bit of everything, or engaged with a little bit of everything. But for the most part, it was building out, you know, a current subdivision, you know, and you know, some of the properties I was involved with, or you know, had, you know, anywhere from 1,000 to 2,000 homes, golf course development. So
wow,
you know, within like 2 years, I was involved with, call it 2,000 to 3,000.
Wow,
you know, this luxury single family home. So I got a great feel for the residential development. It's so much of it, I realized that's just not what I wanted to do. Right.
Yeah,
that's the value in life is understanding, you know, when to go right and when to go left and why. And it was a phenomenal opportunity. And I just learned, hey, I didn't want to do residential anymore. So I went back to commercial, and I worked in New York City for, at the time they were the largest and a fee developer in the world. It was a joint venture between Bovis, which was one of the world's largest construction management companies out of London, and then Lendlease, which was one of the world's largest REITs out of Australia. And we had a partnership called the Global Alliance with BP, British Petroleum, out of London, and we were managing their retail real estate development across the world. And I was happy to be back in the commercial world for a bit.
So, you know, another quick side note, I actually applied for Toll Brothers right out of college.
Oh yeah.
Cause it's the same thing. I was like, these guys are the go-to name in development, for decades and, you know, generations. And so I was like, I want to learn from somebody that's really knows what they're doing and can be like my MBA in real estate. It didn't end up working out, but I, you know, I'm fortunate the way my path ended up. But yeah, it's powerful to really learn from those who have gone before you and you know, kind of done what you want to do. And it literally turns decades into days on your path towards learning that craft and becoming an expert in that craft.
Evan, don't feel bad. I wanted to get a job there right out of college, and they didn't accept my resume. I didn't have the right background. So it took me a while to get there. Then I finally got there, and I realized, hey, this isn't really what I want to do. But
yeah,
I agree with you. It's important to learn from the best and surround yourself with the best. And it helps you make a lot of really smart decisions down the road, especially when you're trying to figure out, you know, what you're passionate about, what you want to be successful at.
So when you were at the Bovis Lendlease partnership and you were at Toll Brothers, what do you think were some of the biggest things that imparted on you and your decision making going forward?
Yeah, they have both of them, you know, Toll Brothers in particular has a very unique structure to them. It's very black and white. And a lot of people can duplicate it, and they can plug pieces in and out very easily. You know, Bovis Lendlease, massive international partnership corporation, just great people from the top to the bottom and the bottom to the top. Very experienced people working domestically, internationally. They just knew how to get it done. And when you surround yourself with those organizations or in those organizations with those kind of people, good things tend to come. At a minimum, great experience and great relationships. And I've stayed in touch with a lot of those people through the years to this day.
So after Bovis Lendlease, walk us through how you got to where you are today.
Yeah, I was there for, I guess I was there for 5 years in New York. And then I went with them from New York to Los Angeles. And all along, I kind of knew that's not what I wanted to do. You know, I had done so much for developers where other people had made a lot of money, but I didn't understand how to make the money side of it. I always wanted my own business. I always wanted to go out on my own. And I really always wanted to be a real estate developer like you, Evan. and I was trying to gather the pieces in order to do that. And about at that point in time, I came to the realization that, hey, I have a lot of the pieces. I just didn't really understand the financial side of it. So I wanted to go back and get my MBA. On the side, I was playing around with certain things. You know, I was looking at land. How can I buy this myself? Can I entitle it? Can I flip it? I was going to certain conferences, listening to certain gurus about how to do this, how to do that. So the entrepreneur in me was kind of being born in my head.
Yeah.
As I was trying to take the next step. But I'm an engineer by trade. So I need to take that next step before I jump. And at some point, with a lot of people with that type of personality is you just take step after step after step after step and you never jump. But fortunately for me, you know, that wasn't the case. So in Los Angeles, while I was working for them, I went back and got my master's at USC. Fantastic program. Their entrepreneurship program is tops in the country. And the founder of the entrepreneurship program became a very close friend. And, you know, he started to do what you and I talked about earlier. He put me in touch with some really successful developers nationwide, specifically out of Southern California. And I had these informational interviews and I would explain what I wanted to do and why I wanted to do it. And most of these guys, actually all of them, I still remember where I met the two gentlemen. They both said, "Hey, Mike, you're ready now.
You know, yeah.
You're ready to jump. It's time to fly." And it's about that time I left the corporate world. I partnered with some investment bankers and successful real estate guys out of Manhattan Beach, California. And we started to do some development in Southern California and in New York. And that's about the time, a couple years later, that's when 2008 hit and everything got turned upside down and it was ready to go on the attack and understand what was next coming out of, for me, you know, the worst recession of our generation.
Yeah. Yeah. And I want to dive into that, but I want to quickly back up to what you said about the informational interviews. I think that's good to highlight for our Monumental listeners, because that's something I always talk about. Anybody I talk to, coaching clients or just friends or colleagues, it's trying to think about how you can start up conversations with people who are ahead of you or where you want to be or mentors or potential, you know, partners. And it is so powerful to find a way to have those conversations, even if it's, you know, 15 minutes, 30 minutes, an hour, a couple different phone calls. And that's kind of what a podcast is for me and other podcast hosts, is it allows us to connect. It allows us to build a relationship, and it allows us to dive in and build a deeper relationship. And for our listeners to learn your craft, just as you did many years ago, you're a pioneer, you know, learning from those ahead of you.
Yeah, that, you know, some people are super successful just jumping and doing it. You know, some people, it takes time, and they need to have the background, the experience, take the right steps to get to that point. And sometimes things just happen to you, and they throw you into that spot. And for me, 2008 was part of that. I told someone the other day, it's like, hey, I was made in 2008, because that's when, at that point in time, I had done a little bit of everything, hospitality. I was flying around in helicopters, landing on deserted beaches in Costa Rica and Dominican Republic and Puerto Rico. And it was really cool and new and sexy. Great things to add to your social media sites. None of that panned out. You know, in 2008, it didn't matter how good you were, how smart you were, everything shut down. Everything got turned upside down, which for me was some development projects in New York and Southern California, and the office condo market got shut down, and it was time to go, okay, this was really painful. I lost a lot of money, but what's next? And, you know, as Warren Buffett has said over and over and over, you know, it's, you know, what do you want to buy when there's blood in the streets?
Yeah.
And certainly that was the case then. We might be in a very similar circumstance here shortly.
So what were your biggest takeaways from that painful experience of the 08-09 recession?
I think one was just education. Being able to quickly make decisions based off of your background and your experience. I think surrounding myself for a decade with good people and good mentors was very helpful. But a lot of it was the belief that so many of us have, you know, when you jump, you always know you're going to land on your feet. And I realized very quickly, hey, this was not a time to be depressed. This was an opportunity. It was time to be opportunistic going forward. Now's the time when you know, money is to be made and opportunity is to be had. So that was the big takeaway for me. But going back to my comment on education, it was time to learn and make a decision. Okay, I had done office, residential, retail, hospitality, you know, resort development. Okay, I was the jack of many trades.
Yeah.
Which growing up, I thought that was a good thing. You know, I love to be the well-rounded person. But I've also learned that a lot of success comes from, you know, and you and I have talked about this with what you do, picking one thing and becoming an expert at that one thing. So I researched, I went and listened to a number of gurus speak on their trade, you know, in 2008, 2009, you know, and I remember going to see one guy talk about, I think it was industrial. And I said, hey, Bob, you know, can I buy you a cup of coffee afterwards? So we sat down for a cup of coffee and I said, hey, Bob, are you doing industrial now? And he looks over his head and goes, I'm buying apartments. And I said, apartments? I'm not interested in apartments. So, you know, coming out of the recession, apartments wasn't really what I was looking to do. I had owned some small apartments here and there and didn't have the greatest experience with it. But the more I learned and talk with others about what was the next trend, what was the next opportunity coming out of the Great Recession, for many, including myself, it was apartments. People needed a place to live. Millennials were in their prime. No one was buying homes, and it was a great time to jump into, you know, a new asset class, a new industry that I really believed in. I was looking to create a sustainable real estate business model, which is hard to say in real estate. But the beauty of apartments is they historically do very well when times are good. And compared to a lot of other investments, they do pretty well and they survive pretty well through the downturns.
So coming out of 08, 09, how soon was it before you made that first purchase and formed that the company to make that happen?
Yeah, the first deal was an 80-unit deal built in 1982 in Odessa, Texas. I was part of a networking group. Another gentleman had this deal under contract. He was struggling to raise the capital to make it happen, needed a partner. So I partnered up with him. You know, about 2 weeks before closing, I found out that, you know, most of the money he said he had raised didn't come to fruition. So I had to go round up someone else to help last minute, you know, bring in the last half a million or 800,000. And we were able to get that first deal closed. And the second deal I closed was a 232 unit deal right across the street. So, you know, it really started, you know, one deal at a time, climbing out of 2009.
Yeah, I remember you telling me that previously when we were talking is, you know, really taking the mindset of, you know, as you're building momentum, just focus on that first deal and building one deal at a time, and then the momentum will grow to where, you know, you can build the machine to be doing like you did last year. What would you say it was, $175 million you did last year?
Yeah. And it was only three deals, but they were bigger deals. But you're exactly right. I remember speaking to some groups, you know, 5-6 years ago, and they're like, how did you do it? What's your story? And nothing's changed. It's doing the right thing, surrounding yourself with the right people, and taking care of your investors. And when you do that, tying back to what we said earlier, when you do that with good due diligence, people notice it. They understand that you're fact oriented and you do the right homework up front, and you're there to protect their dollars. And that's a trait, you know, a characteristic that investors follow. They want to stay with you when they know that you're looking out for them first. But it starts really one deal at a time. And like I said, you know, 2009 was one deal. 2010 was one deal. The next year was two deals. The next year was one deal. So, you know, it's four or 5 years of doing one or two deals. And the reality of it is, good deals are really hard to find, especially when you're starting doing something you hadn't done before and you don't have a following and you can't raise capital. And you don't know a lot of investors, it just takes time. Like anything in life, nothing happens overnight.
Yeah.
It's borderline impossible to be successful overnight or 1 year or retire wealthy. It takes a lot of time. It takes a track record.
Yeah.
I always say trust and track record is the most important thing in my business. And then that momentum, you know, what you just said, and then it starts to really pick up, you know, suddenly, you know, you start from raising 500, you know, 1,000 to a million, and suddenly you're raising 5 million to 10 million to 15 million. Suddenly you're doing, instead of two or three deals a year, you're doing four deals a year, or five deals a year, six deals a year. And the reality of it is when you're trying to do the right thing for your investor, it's okay if you have a year you don't do anything. And if you have do one great deal a year, great. If you do zero, no problem. If you do five or six, great. And for us, that's what it's really been all about. And as I said, I've got a great team. I've got a great partner. that raises capital alongside of me, and we invest our personal dollars alongside of each other. We're both signing off on all the lender carve outs together. And it's, you know, it's a process that starts with hard work, and trust and confidence. And over a period of time, you're able to create a nice track record of success.
What, speaking of your partnership and your group with L5, can you walk us through your thought process behind forming a partnership and then also segueing that into building out your team to what it is today?
When you say a partnership, what exactly? A partnership to buy a property or what exactly?
Forming companies together, partnering within L5.
Gotcha. Yeah, I think for a lot of new people starting off, you always hear horror stories about partnerships. There's pros and cons. You probably hear more bad things about partnerships than good things about partnerships. So I think finding the right group and the right person is really important. Doing your due diligence, just like on a real estate deal, you have to do it on your partner. And if they're uncomfortable with that, it's a red flag right off the bat. You know, a good partner understands that, hey, they need to understand your pros and cons and vice versa. You know, your successes, your failures, vice versa. You know, I'm surprised through the years how many people have never done a background check on me. I recommend everyone do a background check on your partner. Not everyone is who they say.
Yeah.
Who they say they are. You know, a lot of people say, hey, we closed this and we closed that, and they're a guru and they're speaking on podcasts and they're up on stage and everyone, yeah, they're creating all this energy, right? There is suddenly an industry expert and everyone wants to partner with them. But back to the basics, you know, it doesn't matter who they are, do a background check. Track record. Okay, we closed, you know, 2,000 deals, 10,000 deals, whatever. Can I see your track record on what you've done? Not on what you've closed, but how you've performed for your people, your investors. Yeah. What did you project versus how did you do? That's a great way to really understand, you know, who you're getting into bed with.
Yeah, that's a great point. And I completely agree with background check. I think that's, you know, I've heard time and again from my mentors, it's, and from working with other groups and seeing firsthand what good and bad partnerships look like, it's do your homework before you get in bed with somebody. I mean, you're marrying somebody for potentially a very long time, and you're sharing a lot with that person. So make sure you're on the same page and going in the same direction and share the same core values.
Yep. And it's the same thing with our investors and any investors. You know, when you bring on an investor or you invest with someone, you're a partner. At least that's how we look at an investor. Not everyone looks at investors as partners. We certainly look at them because we're invested right alongside of them and vice versa. But a lot of investors, you got to ask those questions. You know, a lot of people can talk the talk, not a lot can walk the walk. And don't be afraid to ask, you know, for their track record. And if they hem and they haw and they can't provide it, it's probably not who you want to be working with. You know,
yeah.
I know with us, and we don't often get asked for it, but you know, we encourage people, hey, please look at our one page track record of every deal we've closed over a decade. Here are the returns on every deal we've closed. Here's a list of references who are investors that have been in 10 to 20 deals with us. They've seen the good, the bad, and the ugly. Unfortunately, there hasn't been any bad and ugly. But being able to confirm, I keep saying the word trust and track record. It's a very important, powerful term in our business when it comes to partnership and investors.
And so segueing that into what's going on right now, focusing in on that trust and track record, how are you looking at what's going on with COVID-19 and how you can leverage that trust and track record that you all have and you've built up over the last decade to kind of segue into what could be potential opportunity going forward?
Well, I think right now it's really time to pause and assess. There's so much volatility out there. It's slowed down a little bit, thank God, but you don't know what's going to happen within the next hour, let alone tomorrow or next week. When do states get back to work? When does the light switch get turned back on? You know, what's the long-term impact to the service industry? We're listening to different economists speak all day long. You know, there's no consistency there. No one's really sure. And I think that's the honest answer, is just to say, hey, we're not sure what May is going to bring. Let's focus on that first. We're not sure what June is going to bring. When does this recover? I don't know. You know, I love multifamily because we're so focused month to month on financials. We have short-term leases typically that are 12 months. So I'm confident that we're in a great spot to really understand where we hope and think the bottom is when occupancy stable out, specifically economic occupancy stables out, delinquencies slow down and stabilizes. You know, across my portfolio, we're in 10 states from California to Virginia, you know, west to east, east to west. So we have a really good, I think coming out of this, we'll have a really good feel.
Yeah.
For where we're at, again, with apartments, I'd say 50% plus of our tenants are directly tied to the service industry. Right now we're 100% focused on our properties and collections and heads and beds and keeping our tenants safe and our people safe, hoping they pay their rent through this. And fortunately we've seen that. I think I told you last month. Gosh, April 1, the last 2 weeks of March were so crazy. I wasn't sure if anyone was going to pay rent on April 1. As of yesterday, this week, we were at about 94.4% collections, which certainly is lower than our average, which is typically 98 to 99% at this time of the month. But compared to where we thought we might be,
it was a
pretty good month. May, on the other hand, I think will be worse. How much worse? I just don't know. This is the time where, you don't have to predict anything. It's really taking it one step at a time. But I think May will be a lot better than what we thought it could be. Unemployment checks are coming. Stimulus checks are coming. April, if it's an indicator, was a lot better than we expected. But coming out of this, I'm excited. I mean, I think we're going to find some wonderful opportunities when it ties back to trust and track record. We have a great following of investors. I had 3 calls this morning with investors that say, hey, when's the time to get back in, Mike?
Yeah.
What do you have that we can invest in now? Because they certainly don't, we're sitting on dollars and they don't want to put it in the market. And they understand that what we do is a very smart, stable place to put your money. With multifamily, it's not about hitting home runs. It's not about hitting triples either. It's about hitting smart singles and doubles. And with good due diligence, good people, good locations that are surrounded by employment centers, good retail jobs, mass transit, those are really smart things to invest in with a long-term mindset, whether it's now or in 6 months. But we certainly believe that as we recover out of this, we'll be in a great spot to acquire some really strong opportunities.
Yeah, and I want to touch on kind of a theme I've heard from you today and then also from us talking previously, is you really take what you do to heart, and you're really a good steward of other people's capital, and you treat your investors as partners, and you ask those open, smart questions, and you're doing your homework on the front end, because you don't want to make an investment that's not a sound, highly thought through investment. And I think that's gotten you to where you are today. And it's going to lead to even more opportunity out of this because of your, hitting on it again, your trust and your track record. I think if it all comes back to what they've said, others have said, is it just comes down to the name you have on your back is that's all you have. And so you have to protect that, and you have to respect the power that that carries in the momentum that can help you build for finding future deals and building the life of impact and the wealth for your family and your company and your impact in the end.
Yeah. Oh, all you die with is your reputation. It takes a long time to build it. You can lose it in a day.
Yeah.
But if you're patient about it and you do the right thing and you do your homework, you treat your partners, your investors with respect. There's a lot of good that can come from that.
Yeah. And patience too, what you said, I think right now is like, hey, let's just focus on the properties we have and making sure they perform well. And then preparing our investors and preparing for the next round of opportunity.
Yep. Yeah. I mean, we're buying a property right now. Our initial offer was at $31 million. We're now under contract at $27.5 million.
Wow.
As of a week ago. So, there's going to be some opportunities out there. This is a unique opportunity because we have an investor with some significant 1031 money that has to deploy it now, or he's going to lose $2 million in taxes. So it's definitely a little bit out of our box from a timing standpoint, but there'll be some opportunities out there. We're starting to see them. And cap rates, I think, for those of you that understand cap rates, it's very important to stay in front of your people, your brokerage community. What's happening with deals right now? Are they falling out of contract and why? Are they closing? If they are closing, at what cap rates, at what price per unit, price per pound are they closing? To really understand what's a good deal and what's a deal a broker is just selling to you over the next 6 months, I think it's going to be really important for people.
Yeah. And I think what you touched on too is, understanding all of what's going on and also understanding that right now we're walking through a acquisition right now as well. And you have a lot more leverage or a lot more ability to say, hey, I have all the time in the world. I don't need to close on this right now. But use the situation to your advantage to say, hey, I can either be patient or I can, try to see if I can get better terms to make sure we protect ourselves.
There's no doubt about it. I mean, before this started, we were, there was hard money everywhere. We couldn't get in the best and final without $250,000 and $500,000 of hard money. A financing contingency. When I started the business, who would buy anything without a financing contingency?
Yeah.
Over the last year, you weren't competitive if you included a financing contingency. Don't even submit your offer.
Yeah.
Which is crazy. Those are telling signs that, we're at the end of a really good run.
A frothy market.
I used to say we're in the 18th inning of a 9-inning baseball game. We're in the extra innings here. And who knows, it could last another five innings. But, I think we've finally seen that come to an end. And to your point, things have changed, right? Hard money's out the door. You have to have a financing contingency. The nice thing is, in comparison to 2008, there was no debt. There was no equity. Now, there's still great debt out there. Fannie and Freddie are still in business. Interest rates are still low. Certainly things have changed with how you underwrite with regard to higher reserves, higher debt coverage ratios, lower leverages, but it's still out there. They still believe in multifamily. And it's a lot better spot to be in, but you still need your financing contingency. You need to do your homework and you don't want to be locked into a loan that could change within the next 30 to 60 days because of all the volatility that we're seeing and we just don't quite understand yet.
Yeah. And I think that segues into what another thing I wanted us to dive into was, surrounding ourselves by others and learning from others, and both of us being in the Infinite Eight Mastermind. I wanted to get your take on what that experience has been like for you, and how that's impacted your decision making, and so on and so forth.
Yeah, I haven't done anything like this before. You know, I've been out of the networking circle for feels like a long, long time. I got three little kids at home in lockdown with me here, and that's been our focus over the last 5 years. So for me, we talked before about surrounding yourself with good people and networking, and for me, this is really what it's been, Evan, is getting out and sharing thoughts, ideas, business, social, with some really successful people such as yourself. And only good things can come with surrounding yourself with those kind of people. So I think through this, you know, coronavirus time period, for me, it's been a lot of fun.
Yeah.
I love just surrounding myself with smart people. Intellectually, it keeps your brain moving, thinking, and then personally, I mean, hey, I wouldn't be on this call with you. I wouldn't have gotten to know you. I mean, you and Tyler are great. I mean, you're in a very similar spot to where I was 10 years ago in the last recession, and it's just great. You know, like I explained to you earlier when I said education brought me out of 2008. It's the same thing with this mastermind group. You're learning from others. What are they seeing? What are they thinking? What are they doing, you know, health-wise, family-wise,
yeah,
dollar-wise, from an investment standpoint? And I've really enjoyed it. I think there's a lot of only positive growth that can come from it.
Yeah, same here. I've never been in a formal mastermind like this before. And it's been a game changer, just because we can share so much. You know, it's almost like you get an open book to other successful people's way of going about life and business and relationships and happiness and health and wealth. So it's really cool that we get to share that and also share the journey together. Because especially, like, you know, when we started the mastermind, it was a couple months ago, before any of COVID-19. And so now we get to go through this unique, interesting, weird, you know, experience together, and hopefully come out much further ahead and having learned a lot more because we're sharing that experience.
Yeah. And I'm a big believer in following the success of others, not trying to reinvent the wheel. So yeah. And I think that ties to our mastermind group, where it's not a bunch of guys just, you know, brainstorming. We have someone that's really put it together, which is Trevor McGregor, you know, one of the top executive coaches in the world, really, who's done this before, that's really leading us through the right steps from, you know, self-growth,
yeah,
to you know, some hopefully making some smart business decisions together as a team. We made a huge donation,
yeah,
to a charity that's helping, you know, navigate COVID right now, which is called Family Promise. We made that as a big decision together, and we're seeing. Yeah, I think you mentioned you and your fiance were going to make a donation. One of my properties made a big donation the other day, so there's a lot of good that's going to come from it, Evan.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And I wanted to touch on that. I know that's been part of your mission and your impact previously, and then even we've talked about how you want to dive into that even further of, you know, how can you give back, how can you take you know, the what you've gained throughout your life, and how can you figure out how to help others on their journey. Can you touch a little bit of what you've been able to do to date, and then what you see going forward?
Yeah, I mean, this past month has been a great opportunity for me to do some thinking. I always find that I'm at my best when I have time to do my thinking. A lot of times that's when I'm on a plane across the country,
yeah,
where you have time to take your head out of the sandbox a bit. But, you know, my focus really lately has been building, you know, my family foundation and trying to figure out how to give back, make an impact, leave a legacy. Get my family involved with making some very impactful decisions. I'm looking at a list here in front of me. I'm going to be on the board of an innovation startup acceleration nonprofit to help other charities make an impact on COVID coming out of this. We're brainstorming about building homes for the less fortunate in different countries, building computer labs for schools domestically, internationally, establishing a micro loan fund for third world entrepreneurs. So, there's really disasters like this that sometimes put us in a position to make some powerful decisions on how to help others short term, long term.
That's really, really cool what you're doing. And I think that's exemplary for our listeners and for myself. How can we constantly be thinking about how we can impact others who may be a little bit less fortunate than us, and trying to have, just as you're reaching up to learn from your mentors, you're reaching down and helping others and pulling them up. So I think that's really powerful, and that's going to have an amazing impact. And also, even like we talked about offline, is there's just like COVID-19 and recession and different catastrophic world events, economic events like this, they typically, a lot of times, they affect everybody. But economically, they typically affect those that were already at the lower half of the economic or social ladder. And it's unfortunate, but those are typically the families that they're already down. Sometimes they get, hit even harder, especially now COVID-19. There's families that work more in retail, more in physical jobs, physical locations, are getting sick more often. They're at risk a lot more. And so it's going to take a lot more action and a lot more like thoughtful, intentional purpose towards helping those families coming out of a situation like this.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. And we just don't know how long this situation will last. I mean, there's a lot of us that think this is a 3-month period and we're back to the norm. There's a number of folks that say, hey, third quarter, fourth quarter of this year is going to be fantastic. The market will have fully recovered. It'll be back to business as usual. And then, as we continue to learn about the overall, secondary, tertiary impacts of COVID, this could put us in a position of recovery for years.
Yeah.
With jobs and unemployment, inflation is a significant concern. I mean, I've heard a couple economists, compare our recovery to Japan. For a long period of time. So we'll see. I think it's too early to really tell. It's just important we keep talking and educating ourselves and trying to help others and make some good decisions as we learn more day by day here.
Yes, and making that monumental impact. I love it.
Love it.
So one last question before we dive into our monumental questions. I wanted to ask you something kind of off the beaten path, but I'm just curious, what is your favorite or most enjoyed investment that you've made outside of real estate?
I don't have a lot of investments outside of real estate. I have a good friend who's one of my investors, very successful investment banker. He gave me a hard time the other day saying I'm not diversified enough, but I'd rather be diversified within something I know and understand than not. And I'll take the downside that comes with that. And I don't think the downside is really that bad when it comes to multifamily compared to some other industries, as I said. But for me, the most interesting really has been my investment in Facebook. I'm very good friends with the founder of an independent financial advisory firm in Los Angeles. He manages my money, my family's money. His group invests anywhere from 2 to 4 million in each of our real estate deals. So we know them pretty well, but he put me in an opportunity to invest in Facebook, pre-IPO.
Oh wow!
And if you remember that IPO, you know it got mishandled there a bit, and it looked really good. And then it, for the longest time, it was pretty flat, right?
Yeah.
And when we invested, pre-IPO, you're buying from a private individual, and my friend had negotiated. I guess in order to do that, you had to set up an investment club in order to legally buy off private shares and have it be approved by the SEC. So this investment club had found someone in Europe that was willing to sell some of their shares, private shares of Facebook. And it was one of the early investors. And we struck a contract with him, and we just waited forever, Evan, for him to sign the paperwork. And the secretary kept saying, he travels a lot. He's not here. So finally, my friend called me into the office and said, hey, I got the deal done. Let's come on in and sign the paperwork. So we finally got it done. We're signing the paperwork. And I'm walking out of the office. And I said, hey, Spencer, who was this guy anyway? I think it was David Hewson. I'm going to look it up because it's kind of funny. And we had to do the same thing. We're like, who is that? David Hewson. Who the heck is David Hewson? And you Google it, and it's Bono from U2. So for the longest time, the Facebook stock wasn't worth much, but the signature of having Zuckerberg and Bono was worth its price in gold.
That's awesome.
So that's my most interesting non-real estate investment story. And as a result, obviously Facebook stock has recovered, to say the least. But
that's an interesting story. I did not expect that at all.
I still have that signature block in my office, both their signatures on it.
That's awesome. I love that. I'm glad you shared that. So let's dive into our monumental questions. What does success mean to you?
Well, I think success means something I touched on earlier. It's, hey, when you leave this world, you leave it in a good place, a better place. You leave with a good reputation. You made an impact on others. You made an impact on your family. You made one small step to make the world a better place. The size of that step is obviously dependent on the person and their opportunity and their impact. But for me, big picture, that's my definition of success. That's really interesting. I've never said that or told that to anyone. And for me personally, it really ties to that. It's trying to leave a legacy for my kids, my family, and trying to continue to make an impact on my business, our employees, both in the field and in the office, to help us to get to where we're at, continuing to make an impact to our investors. We couldn't be anywhere without, the trust and loyalty of our investors, my family, and trying to, I mentioned a couple ideas earlier, trying to continue to explore how we can consistently give back and make an impact to others who maybe haven't had the opportunities that many of us have had in growing up and through life.
Yeah, I love that. What about morning habits or daily rituals that you have?
I drink a lot of coffee. I'm definitely a sports guy. I've done a better job getting in shape lately. I'm not a very habitual guy. I'm a very project by project guy, where when things are hot and heavy, I'm all in, day and night. Sleep is optional. But I'm not one of these guys that has this unique habit that keeps me going. I think I'm very grounded in that. I always go back to what's important, which is, people, family, trying to stay healthy, more than anything else. I know, a lot of people read. I'm not a huge reader. I used to be, I'm trying to trying to improve a little bit. I think you and I were talking about, you know, this book the other day. But, you know, continuing to try to reinvent yourself, stay consistent, make an impact overall. One habit I like to do is really just give me some time to think, clear your head, think out of the box, brainstorm, I think is a very healthy activity for at any point in time, especially now. It's easy to be all over the place. We're not used to working at home. Our schedules have been turned upside down. Our habits are very different. And it's very easy to lose focus during a period like this.
Yeah, I agree. I think that was something for the first part of, you know, quarantine. I think I was kind of running all over the place. And then I was like, wait a second, I need some time for me, for my thoughts, for brainstorming and no distractions. And I think that like going to Cal Newport's book, he talks about in Deep Work, he talks about, he's like, having you time and focus time for a couple hours is so powerful. And we need more of that.
There's no doubt about it. I wish I could give myself more of it, but when I do, it's powerful.
Yeah. So what about, you mentioned what you were just holding up, for those who aren't watching the video, he just held up the Principles book by Ray Dalio. As far as favorite book or book you're currently reading, are there any other books on top of Principles?
Yeah, my go-to book is Think and Grow Rich by Napoleon Hill. I was talking with Trevor about that the other day, but that's, I've probably read it 5 times and I've never finished it, which is really interesting. It's my go-to book for focus and motivation, but I often get halfway through and I've got my fix and I'm ready to go.
Yeah.
You know, it's underlined and highlighted through and through, but I was trying to find, I couldn't find it before our call here. I wanted to take a look at it, but if someone told me I only made it 3/4 of the way through, it wouldn't surprise me.
I love it. Yeah, that's a monumental book. Well, in wrapping up, first off, I want to say thank you, Mike, for phenomenal interview, phenomenal stories, sharing your stories, sharing your ups and downs and lessons learned, and really getting to dive into how to, you know, have impact and find the opportunity coming out of COVID-19. So I appreciate you for that. As far as our monumental listeners following you or reaching out to you, where can they go to do that?
Yeah, sure. Our website is L5invest.com, letter L, number 5invest.com. We're actually in the middle of redoing our website. It's a little dated. And then my personal email, if you have any questions on multifamily, have an interest in investing, whatever, please reach out to me. It's Mike, M-I-K-E, at the letter L, the number 5invest, I-N-V-E-S-T.com. And then Evan's got my phone number. Don't hesitate to call or text as well. It's a great time to stay in front of each other right now.
I love it. Guys, take Mike up on that. He is a wealth of knowledge. He's somebody I've already learned a lot from in our friendship, and I appreciate everything you're doing, Mike. And monumental listeners, if you are listening right now, please go rate, subscribe, review this episode on iTunes or wherever you're listening. That helps us grow our monumental community. And on top of that, if you enjoyed today's episode with Mike and myself, make sure to share it on social media, tag both of us, let us know you're listening. And guys, with that, have a monumental day.